Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Richard Eskow of the Campaign for America's Future, who assesses why the Obama administration has taken so long to respond to public demands to investigate big banks and Wall Street mortgage fraud. Bruce Hamilton of the Sierra Club, who discusses the controversy over news that the environmental group had accepted $26 million in donations from the natural gas industry between 2007 and 2010. And Teresa Moran of Labor Notes magazine, who talks about Indiana's recent adoption of anti-union right-to-work legislation and how organized labor is responding. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
At the African Union Summit held in Ethiopia this past January, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called on African leaders to respect gay rights and to recognize how bias against sexual orientation harms people. This statement comes only weeks after British Prime Minister James Cameron and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton threatened to withhold aid to developing nations that do not respect gay rights. Homosexuality is illegal in numerous African countries, including key Western allies like Uganda, Nigeria, Kenya, Egypt, and Botswana. In 2009, Uganda debated a bill that would have invoked the death penalty for certain homosexual acts. The bill was later withdrawn after it received heavy criticism from human rights groups and Western governments. Meanwhile, the Nigerian Senate, which is dominated by conservative Christians and Muslims, has passed legislation to criminalize same-sex marriage. And the BBC reports that in Egypt, all key political factions oppose gay rights. Activists gathered at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, blasted the move toward green capitalism in the run-up to the Rio+20 United Nations Sustainability Summit, scheduled for this June. In a series of reports, the UN has urged the global community to embrace the green economy as the path to reaching sustainable development and fighting poverty. A report by the UN Panel on Global Sustainability identified 56 recommendations to shape debate at the Rio+20 summit, including ending subsidies for fossil fuels, promoting gender equality, and seeking longer-term time horizons in financial markets. At the World Social Forum, Professor Edgardo Lander of Venezuela's Central University called the agenda for the Rio+20 summit an attempt to reimpose capitalism with a new facade. He further stated the Rio summit will take place at a time of profound crisis for capitalism, with severe problems resulting from the limits to growth and the destruction of the conditions of life. Activists at the Social Forum also denounced growing global inequality since the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. 20 years ago, the richest fifth of the world controlled 83% of global income. Today, the wealthy control 92% of global income. Economist Marcos Arruda proposes an alternative economic model known as the solidarity economy to promote the interests of small communities and local governance while putting a brake on growth and planning in such a way that takes into account future generations. The conservative Tea Party movement that emerged shortly after President Obama was sworn into office has much diminished since its early days when angry town hall meetings and protests captured headlines. The movement currently maintains a decidedly lower profile after the GOP captured control of the House of Representatives in 2010, an historic shift widely attributed to Tea Party activism. After their political victories in 2010, many Tea Party activists secured jobs with newly elected Republican representatives on Capitol Hill. Corporate-funded political organizations like Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works have expanded their staffs and budgets. Although the network of national Tea Party groups did not coalesce around a more conservative alternative presidential candidate to Mitt Romney, the movement succeeded in pushing almost all GOP candidates, including Romney, to the right on a host of issues. These include cuts in the federal budget, repeal of the Obama health care reform law, the closing of four federal agencies, privatizing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, gutting Amtrak, and the elimination of the National Labor Relations Board. The Washington Monthly reports that although the Tea Party's grassroots base of support and infrastructure has receded since its peak in 2010, think tanks sponsored by big banks and the energy industry have, in essence, taken over the task of guiding the conservative movement forward on its deregulatory, budget-cutting, and privatization agenda. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The film Inside Job, which investigated the causes of the U.S. and global economic meltdown, won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Film in 2011. Upon accepting his Oscar at the award ceremony, the film's director, Charles Ferguson, decried the fact that 3 years after the financial crisis caused by financial fraud, not a single financial executive had gone to jail. Nearly a year later, and 5 months after the birth of the Occupy Wall Street movement, President Barack Obama announced in his January State of the Union address that he was appointing New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman as one of 5 co-chairs of a new Justice Department task force to investigate mortgage fraud by big banks and financial institutions that played a central role in the economic collapse. Earlier, Schneiderman had resisted signing on to a proposed 50-state deal promoted by the Obama administration that would have brokered a commitment from the nation's 5 largest banks to pay $25 billion in relief to present and former homeowners for mortgage robo-signing abuses in exchange for immunity from all prosecution for the bank's illegal conduct that contributed to the economic failure in 2008. Schneiderman's resistance to the Obama offer of immunity could in the end result in a settlement mandating more accountability from big banks. Independently of other states, Schneiderman launched lawsuits on February 3rd against Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo for their deceptive and fraudulent use of a shell company, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, or MERS, used to register mortgage loan ownership. Your reporter spoke with Richard Eskow, a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future, who discusses the nation's shifting political climate that has caused the Obama administration to take a tougher stand in holding Wall Street accountable for mortgage fraud that led to the nation's economic collapse.
Look, we have a situation where the president was elected at a historic moment with a historic mandate to force real change on Wall Street and to hold criminals accountable, to track them down and hold them accountable. He didn't do that. That's a historic disappointment. I feel that's a terrible thing that he acted the way he did for whatever reason. And, you know, the Justice Department's record of non-prosecution of bank, you know, bankers, even in cases where the evidence seemed overwhelming, is extraordinarily disappointing and even shameful. But I think a couple things happened to change the dynamic. One was Occupy Wall Street. The energy that got Barack Obama elected in 2008 was, first of all, totally dissipated away from him, as we saw in the 2010 election. Young people voted in lower numbers in 2010 than they did in 2006, before most of them had heard of Barack Obama. So that energy went away from him, and a lot of it was galvanized by Occupy Wall Street, either directly or by the emotions and, you know, feelings that Occupy generated and the change in the debate to economic fairness. So the president recognizes that, and I think he and his advisors realize that they can't pretend. He stopped saying what I think is one of the worst things, least credible things he's ever said. He had this standard line, speech line, Main Street and Wall Street rise and fall together. That's just flatly not true, number one. So he realizes he has to do something, and he realizes now the level of public outrage that bank crimes have not been prosecuted. So now, in the meantime, it is statute of limitations may have run out on some crimes and so on, but till a couple couple of weeks ago, he had been pushing yet another cushy deal with the banks, because we've had a lot during his administration, as well as the Bush administration, where they could write a small check, relatively speaking, to get away from big crimes. Now he realizes, because Eric Schneiderman in New York, where a lot of the big banks are headquartered, and Kamala Harris in California, wouldn't sign on to the deal, he realized he had to deal with them. He realized he was dealing with a different national mood, a lot of activist groups trying to keep the pressure on. So I think now he's trying to, you know, weave his way through placating the banks on the one hand, because, you know, he does get elected in a system where corporate money drives elections. So I think he's dealing with that on the one side, and on the other, public outrage. And I think it's the job of the public to keep the pressure on the president and other politicians to make sure justice is served. You know, while there's the lawsuit from the state of New York, but we also need to know that criminal investigations will be made and that individual bankers who committed crimes will be prosecuted. More than 1,000 big bankers went to jail after the savings and loan scandal, which was a tiny fraction of the scope of what went on in this decade.
Richard, what do you think of Eric Schneiderman as co-chair here? He has certainly fought for preventing the banks from getting a free pass in the mortgage fraud investigations that were ongoing of the many states' attorney generals. Do you think him being one of several co-chairs of this new unit at the Justice Department will make a difference in holding accountable the big banks?
I think he's done a great job up to now, and he's been a hero. And I think that, you know, he's a co-chair with several other people whose records have been terrible. So, you know, with the enforcement officer at the SEC that keeps letting the banks off, with the guy at the Justice Department who's sleeping on the job and who went on 60 Minutes and said what they did was wrong but not illegal, which is demonstrably untrue. But there's no reason right now not to think that that Schneiderman, who just the other day initiated that lawsuit, is not fighting on the side of the angels. So that's what I'm going to assume, unless I hear otherwise.
Big banks and Wall Street firms have so much money and so much power and influence in Washington and state capitals that a lot of people are cynical that we can really change the structure here. There's the view of many that we have a permanent secret government, pulls all the strings, and the parties are really just so much superficial fluff that the real power behind the White House and Congress are these huge banks and financial institutions. How do you think we can overcome that?
One way to diminish the bank's power is by making it clear to at least one party that they can't have it both ways. Another way is to push for a constitutional amendment or some other way to get money out of politics, because right now we have a system of corporate politics, plain and simple. You know, don't despair. I mean, I think the cynicism is the most destructive thing we can do. If we're convinced that the banks have already won, then we won't fight. The public has a lot more power than it realizes. But, you know, I think the idea is we've got to be prepared to do what it takes to fight this banking and corporate government system and be really strong. I mean, nonviolent, but strong about it, saying, you know, if we have to go into the street, we'll go into the street, because otherwise they do win.
That was Richard Eskow, a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. Visit our Between the Lines website, where you'll find more commentary and analysis on Wall Street mortgage fraud and accountability. A blogger for Time magazine revealed on February 2nd that from 2007 to 2010, the Sierra Club, under former executive Carl Pope, had accepted $26 million in donations from individuals and subsidiaries linked with Chesapeake Energy, one of the largest gas drilling companies in the U.S., which is heavily involved in the controversial drilling method known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. The money was donated for the express purpose of funding the environmental group's Beyond Coal campaign. The club's campaign has succeeded in stopping the construction of 160 proposed coal-fired power plants and is now targeting existing coal-fired plants for closure. For years, coal has been considered the world's dirtiest fossil fuel, and natural gas was touted as a cleaner alternative to produce electricity and power transportation. However, more recent scientific studies have exposed the dirtier side of natural gas, including serious pollution problems associated with fracking in gas wells drilled in many states. When Michael Broun was hired in March 2010 to succeed Pope as the Sierra Club's executive director, he ended the payments from the natural gas industry. Brune, formerly with the more militant Rainforest Action Network, declared that the secrecy surrounding Chesapeake's millions of dollars in contributions to the club had jeopardized the group's integrity and relationship with supporters. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Bruce Hamilton, who's been with the Sierra Club since the 1970s and is now the group's deputy executive director. Hamilton discusses what the natural gas industry money was used for, the evolving view about natural gas, and the legacy of Carl Pope, who became the Sierra Club's chairman of the board when Brune was hired, but has since left the organization.
The gifts were restricted to the Beyond Coal campaign. So in that sense, there are strings. You can't go spend it on wilderness protection. So they weren't unrestricted gifts to the Sierra Club to spend on whatever we wanted. But the Beyond Coal campaign proposal that they funded basically said this is money in order to stop the expansion of coal-fired power and ultimately reduce our dependence on it and to promote renewable energy. So it had to be spent on that, and it was spent on that. But there was nothing in the gift agreement that even mentioned the word natural gas.
Even though Carl Pope kept it very quiet, do you think the Sierra Club could have justified accepting natural gas money to attack coal? Because until recently, most environmental groups, including yours, thought of natural gas as a bridge fuel from coal and oil to renewable energy.
You know, I think one can fairly say that the entire environmental community and academic community has had a evolving position on how clean natural gas is. You know, back when the gifts were accepted, you know, there weren't any peer-reviewed science articles out there talking about how bad natural gas fracking was and how, in fact, it was a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. There was, I think, a general presumption, because it was the common knowledge and the basis to say that, you know, gas was about twice as clean as coal. And so as a result, you know, whenever you could switch from a whatever gasoline-powered car to a natural gas car, or a diesel bus to a natural gas bus, or, you know, a power plant shifting over from coal to natural gas, that was generally seen as an environmental plus from a clean air standpoint. Because if you looked at the burn point, natural gas, in fact, is cleaner than coal. But if you look at the entire life cycle, now we know it's much dirtier. And so Mike Brune, when he took over the reins, March 15, 2010, in his first call with the staff as a whole, he said, I have a number of priorities, and one of them is that we have to step up our campaign to hold natural gas accountable and to make sure that, you know, it is not risking communities and causing major environmental degradation.
Is it common practice that the organization could accept such a large contribution from any source and the executive director would be the only one to know about it?
It's very uncommon for this amount of money to ever come into the Sierra Club, what can I say? You know, we don't get very, very large gifts. This particular case, you know, I was not privy to it, and a couple board of directors had a limited knowledge. They didn't know the extent of the gifts, and they didn't know the identities of the donors, and most of the board of directors didn't know at all. And it turns out that that, in fact, is a major hole in our corporate gift acceptance policy and our anonymous donor policy and our notify the board policy. So the other thing that Michael Brune did once he arrived was to work with the board of directors in order to change all those policies so that now there is far greater transparency and any anonymous donation coming in needs to be shared with the board with the size and the strings and everything else.
Bruce Hamilton, what's your opinion about the club taking this money from a major fossil fuel producer?
You know, I believe it was a mistake, and it needs to be corrected, and I was very proud of the fact that Mike ultimately made the decision, and the board unanimously supported him, to go forward and not accept any more gas money and to leave $30 million on the table. It was the subsequent gifts that were pledged, but then ultimately he and the board decided to walk away from.
So Carl Pope stepped down from any staff role in the club last month. Was that related to this whole issue?
I know there were some concerns about Carl, but whether or not that led to this transition or other things led to this transition, that's something that was between the board and Carl, and all I know is the press releases that went out just plotting Carl for his service and his career.
Now that he's gone, how would you evaluate his leadership of the Sierra Club for almost 20 years, because you worked under him for about 15?
He's a brilliant man who has done great things for the Sierra Club and the environmental movement, and he's really transformed the Sierra Club in a number of ways into a broader organization that is more committed to working in communities, to grassroots empowerment, to promoting environmental justice, to having outreach and partnership with labor and communities of color, and I have great admiration for that. But in building the big tent, where he was trying to reach out to all these different constituencies, you know, he also was struggling with trying to figure out how to have adequate resources to fight bigger and bigger battles and challenges like climate change. And at the same time, there were shrinking resources available to the Sierra Club from membership dollars.
Do you think this whole episode will sour members and prospective members and cause an even greater fall off in contributions?
I am certain that a number of individuals will decide that they either don't want to join the Sierra Club or they want to resign their Sierra Club membership. Now, whether it's a significant order of magnitude, I don't know.
That was Bruce Hamilton, the Sierra Club's Deputy Executive Director. Find links to more perspectives on the Sierra Club natural gas controversy on our website at btlonline.org. Last year's coordinated assault on the right of public employees to collectively bargain in states like Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and others was met with protests, referendums, and recall elections sponsored by unions and their allies. Wisconsin, ground zero for resistance to anti-labor legislation, is gearing up for an historic recall election against the state's Republican Governor Scott Walker this spring. Ohio voters overwhelmingly rejected GOP-sponsored anti-union laws in a referendum held in November. But now a new wave of anti-worker measures are making their way through state legislatures controlled by Republicans. Not long before the Super Bowl game in Indianapolis, Indiana became the 23rd state to adopt a right-to-work law after the state Senate passed it and GOP Governor Mitch Daniels signed it on February 1st. Indiana was the first state in a decade to adopt a right-to-work bill, and the first industrial Midwest state to do so. Under right-to-work laws, companies do not have to negotiate contracts with unions that require non-members at the worksite to pay union dues for representation, making payment of monthly union fees optional. Supporters of the law say it will attract more jobs to the state, while unions assert it will reduce all workers' wages. Encouraged by the corporately funded Anti-Union American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, Republicans in Minnesota, Maryland, Maine, Ohio, and Michigan are supporting right-to-work legislation in their states. Your reporter spoke with Teresa Moran, a writer and organizer with Labor Notes magazine, who talks about this latest wave of anti-worker legislation and how organized labor is responding.
So historically, right-to-work has mostly been confined to the South and certain states in the West that typically are not labor strongholds. Indiana is the first Rust Belt state to become a right-to-work state, and now there's a lot of fear that other states will fall like dominoes. So currently, there are right-to-work bills introduced in Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, Maine, Maryland, and other states as well, so there's a real concern that this could spread and reduce the power of unions even further.
Explain right to work, the legislation called right to work. On the face of it, it sounds wonderful. Everybody's got a right to work, but it's a very blatantly anti-union measure. Tell us about it.
So at its core, what right to work does is it allows people to opt out of union membership but still benefit from being a union member and being represented by a contract. So folks are able to opt out of paying dues and also not sign up for the union. And what this does over time, it depletes the resources the unions have to enforce the contract, bargain contracts, service their members, do the research required, and things like that. But even worse than that, like over time, if people are getting the benefits of representation for free, people will decide not to join the union. And a union's power is its showing of strength in numbers. But if membership declines, the union loses its power.
What is the ultimate goal here? Is it to weaken and destroy the labor union movement in this country with these coordinated efforts by Republican-held governorships and state legislatures around the country? And by extension, does this not also translate to an attack directly on the Democratic Party, which certainly gets a lot of its contributions for election campaigns from unions?
Absolutely. It's both an attack on the Democratic Party and an attack on unions nationally, an attack on workers' ability to negotiate their own wages and contracts. It's no surprise, it's no shock that similar bills are popping up in states across the country. Most of these bills are modeled on ALEC legislation. ALEC is a membership organization with both corporate members and legislators, where model legislation is proposed by corporations. You basically have Coca-Cola, the Koch brothers, Walmart drafting bills, legislators voting to approve them as ALEC policy. And then you see these bills being introduced in different states, or, you know, similar, identical bills. And, you know, Right to Work is one such example. Studies have shown that in Right to Work states, average income is $1,500 less a year in Right to Work states than in non-Right to Work states. People in Right to Work states are also less likely to have employer-paid health care or pensions. Folks who support Right to Work have argued that it creates jobs, that it makes a state a more attractive place for businesses to come into. Evidence does not support that at all. The only statistical measures there are in Right to Work show that it reduces wages and job security.
What's been the response in Indiana from the union activists locally? I know that there were some protests. Thousands of people came to the state capitol in Indianapolis and some informational picketing at the Super Bowl. I guess there was a conscious effort not to disrupt or get people angry about any kind of distraction from the Super Bowl itself. But what was the response and what's their next move?
The response has been and had been both to mobilize people out to the protests, but also to educate both the general public and union's own members just in anticipation of such a bill passing, because the goal right now is to educate members, to inform them on why it's important to maintain membership. Now, on a larger scale, folks are considering attempting to win back the legislature, but that's going to be a challenge. It's not as close as it was in Wisconsin.
From covering this issue, what do you think labor should be doing around the country to counter this? What effectively you think could work in their favor at this point?
Since so many states are facing right-to-work bills like the one that just passed in Indiana right now, I think education is crucial. I think that both union members and non-union members alike need to be educated on what right-to-work really means and the importance of unions. And quite frankly, I think that should have happened earlier in Indiana. And I think that states that are currently facing right to work now should take note and start educating now. There should be door-to-door education campaigns. There should be anti-right to work commercials. There should be really strong member education programs in the unions. I think that's what labor needs to be doing.
That was Teresa Moran, a writer and organizer with Labor Notes magazine. Visit our Between the Lines website to find more information on the origins and effects of so-called right to work laws. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.